Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello, and welcome to an hour of mind power. This is Donna Sebo. And today we're going to be talking about a subject that most people, when it's brought up, they sort of shrivel inside of a mental shell. Why? Because many times they maybe have had an experience with a member of their family that has been unpleasant, or maybe they just don't know or understand. What's that subject going to be today? Well, today it's going to be about a person that has a mental illness called schizophrenia. Margaret Hawkins is my guest. She put this book together as a dedication to a sister that she loves a great deal. It's titled, How We Got Barb Back, the story of my sister's reawakening after 30 years of schizophrenia. Margaret, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Donna. It's great to be here.
Margaret, you're a woman that is very, very much, I think, quite sensitive to so many things. You've got an interesting background. You love to write, obviously. You've been a critic. You've been a curator at museums. You're an educator. You teach. You've written for a number of publications during the years. And right now you're involved with the New Arts Journalism Department at the School of Art Institute in Chicago. You've written a couple of novels, but this one about your sister had to have been one that when you wrote it, you probably cried at times when you were writing it. Am I wrong?
No, you're right. And it's interesting that you said that as the first question, because I did. It was so hard to write. I always tell my students kind of jokingly, but it's true, that Robert Frost said, he said this about poetry, but it's true about anything. He said, no tears in the writing, no tears in the reading. And it's true. When people tell me that my book made them cry, I tell them that, because it was very, very hard to write.
It's difficult for most people to write about their own lives. You know, we try to sugarcoat things and make everything seem absolutely perfect and, oh, life is just woo, 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 woo. But it's not that way at all.
No.
And when you put this book together and when I started reading it, I mean, I get all kinds of material. I just got something, in fact, that I was reviewing today that I'm not even going to have on the air because they were talking about schizophrenia, and they've got this little box that they put people into, and I thought, no, this will not do. I cannot deal with that, because this is not an illness that you can tag and say, this is A, this is B, and this is C about it.
No, that's so true, because we don't know, and I say we, but I mean even, I'm not a psychiatrist or a doctor, but nobody knows. Even the experts don't really know, you know, what causes it and what the outcome is. Nobody thought my sister was going to get better.
Mm-hmm. Now, with this, when I was reading through it, it's a story about your family.
Yeah.
It's a story about the traumas that the family went through.
Yes.
It is a story about an era of thinking, an attitude, which
so
sadly
true.
A lot of it has come through even today. Now, is Barb still with us?
Oh, she is very much with us.
Good.
In fact, tomorrow is her birthday. Tomorrow is her 67th birthday. And she's doing great. She's doing better and better. Every time I see her, I'm just stunned by how well she's doing.
This is incredible. Let's go back in history, go back in time a little bit, because you met someone, or no, it wasn't you. It was Carolyn Spiro who met, and she wrote the foreword to your book. She met Art Buchwald.
Right.
Tell us about that meeting and what happened in that meeting.
That's such a striking thing. Carolyn Spiro, to give a little background, is a psychiatrist, and she's also the twin sister, the identical twin sister of a writer who also has schizophrenia. And so, one twin sister is schizophrenic, the other one is a psychiatrist. It's this sort of tragic situation. And she and her sister wrote a book together called Divided Minds. And they were on a book tour. Her sister was able to travel. My sister does not. But they were in the green room waiting to go on a show, or maybe it was a radio show, and they heard a very familiar voice and looked over, and there was Art Buchwald. And, of course, the humorous. He's famous for being a funny man. Mm-hmm. And they started to talk about the book that they were there to discuss. And he, all humor aside, no kidding, proceeded to tell her that his mother had been schizophrenic and spent his whole childhood. His mother was in a mental hospital and died there, and was like his voice was shaking, she told me, as he told her this. And so he had lived his whole life with his stigma, had never discussed it with anyone. He's talked about his own depression on the air. He's no longer with us, but he mm-hmm. had talked about that, but had never, been open about his mother. And it's a measure of the shame. He's an older generation than I am, but still, here's this guy who'd gone public with so much, and he was, at the end of his days, and he's a comic, and he had like turned this pain into humor,
mm-hmm.
but never talked about why.
Define schizophrenia, because there are so many shades of it. And I had someone that presented some material that said, oh, it has all to do with a person's bisexual nature, and I thought, oh, good Lord.
Oh, heaven.
Where
oh.
are you going to with this? Thought, holy Moses. I mean, is this something that you are so into? It's like he's got this Freud complex of some kind. I don't know.
That's just the silliest thing I've heard yet. Everybody has some theory about it. Many people don't even understand what it is. And in common language, sometimes people use it to mean, sort of like a dual nature. And it doesn't even mean that, because of the, schiz means split. But what mm-hmm. it really, the word refers to a brain disease that, we don't know everything about by a long shot. But in general, it's a severe psychiatric condition that's characterized by thought disorders, by hallucinations, by delusions, by reduced affect, the inability to connect with one's emotions. Often there's neurological damage. There's relationships with other people and with former interests are often decreased or even destroyed. But many people have different expressions of it. And there's mm-hmm. paranoid schizophrenia, and then there's other kinds. But often people with this disease are extremely fearful. They're fearful of other people, and they're fearful of the voices that they hear in their heads, which are telling them cruel and threatening things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And often they talk back to those voices, and that's what we see in here. When you're walking down the street and you see some homeless person, mm-hmm. raving out at someone else, and throwing punches at someone who isn't there, that person might very well be schizophrenic.
And the reality is, as you've just said, there is this mental illness, but they don't really know, one, what triggers it,
right.
Two, what the shades of it can really be. They're guessing most of the time, and there is so much about body chemistry that
right.
we just do not understand. We haven't have a clue about it,
right?
And physical trauma, like you've mentioned,
right,
affecting the brain, all of these variables can go on here. Let's talk about 1974, because the very first sentence in your book says, on a promising summer day in 1974, my family's life blew up. What
yeah.
happened?
My sister and her husband came home from Iraq, and they'd been living there for 3 years. He was an academic. He was a professor.
Mm-hmm.
And they came back. because for a visit, but also because something was wrong with my sister. And he was worried, and he was going to bring her home for the summer. He had the summer off. He was a professor. And see if she could be helped by that. So she appeared. They appeared at the airport. My parents picked them up, and there was my sister. And she was, well, or there she wasn't, maybe is a better way to put it. She was gone. She was gone. And instead, there was this tiny, shrunken, terrified person who didn't look the way she looked and didn't act the way she acted and had acted and didn't even speak in the same voice.
Wow.
Yeah.
So it was almost like she had gone through some exceptional trauma and had not, you know, just was there. She was in a world of refuge in the best way she knew how to construct it.
Yeah. Now that's how it seemed, and but of course that's an assumption. It's always, you know, we assumed she'd had trauma, and we assumed that her behavior was an escape from that. But then as we learned more, and I started to do a lot of research. I was 19 at the time. I was, you know, a student and didn't, you know, it was just so alien to all of us. But it began to reveal itself as these classic symptoms of schizophrenia. And she, you know, I became convinced, and doctors have since reassured me that although she, you know, it seemed like a result only of trauma, it seemed like it was probably something that was already there in her, but that the stress of being in another culture, another country where she, you know, couldn't speak English, and who knows what else happened, and we don't, that really was what caused this, what's called a psychotic break. But there were things before that, Donna, there really were, you know, when she was living, you know, in America in safe circumstances where she, you know, looking back, I can see that she was getting sick before she went overseas.
There were patterns. Now, I'm going to step back in time a little bit because apparently your mother's mother had a mental problem because she walked into a lake to commit suicide.
Yeah.
So this is something that, not that I'm saying that it's genetic, but there was a patterning of mental illness, and of course, of the generational attitudes at that time. You just didn't talk about these things. This was horrific. And she walked into a lake and died, and your mom carried that with her. When did you first learn about the information about your grandmother?
Yeah, I don't even know, because it happened, I recall, after like looking back and piecing together all these things, it happened the week of my fifth birthday, and when I became aware that her death was a suicide, I don't even know, but nobody, you know, nobody told me. It was very much a secret, but eventually, you know, kind of the fact of it sort of seeped into my consciousness, and I just don't know when that was. But you know, my mother was so upset, and my mom was you know, troubled also. You know, she had suffered from depression, would be the, you know, way to say it. I hate to place labels, and I hate to make assumptions, but I think it would be fair to, you know, to say that. But she was, you know, she also, assuming that she had severe depression, which I think is true, she was also, you know, had untreated mental illness also. So her mother, you know, committed suicide and had been very high strung and very, you know, she wanted to be a writer. She was this very bright woman, and she did that. And then my mom suffered from depression. And so when my, you know, sister had, didn't seem depressed, but she began to behave in kind of strange ways, it was just sort of, you know, the family kind of tolerated unusual behavior because this was something that, you know, had been passed down through generations.
Your sister was so accomplished when she was in high school. You just admired her. She was beautiful, and this was your big sister. My goodness. She just represented the finest and the best to you, and she was this. And you've got wonderful photos in this book.
Aren't they wonderful?
They are terrific.
She's so beautiful. You know, I mean, it was fun to to be able to put pictures of her in here for everybody to see, you know, what a beautiful woman she mm-hmm. was and is. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, you bring out the fact that your mom and dad had a tenuous type of a relationship. Your dad had a tendency to drink a lot. He was a very controlling type of a person. Your mother, like you said, was high-strung. She was battling with her own issues. And when Barb left home, that was quite a difficult thing for your family to deal with, wasn't it?
It was. It just kind of threw things out of balance. I mean, she went away, she went away to college, but then when she moved out of the country, that was very disturbing. You know, it kind of left people feeling bereft. And then I went off to college right after that. So suddenly my parents had an empty nest. And really, you know, I don't know what would have happened if my sister hadn't come back very mm-hmm. ill after that. Mm-hmm. It's just very hard to predict.
Now, some interesting things happened because Kareem had brought Barb back to the country, your sister. He
yeah.
said she was sick. Now, mm-hmm. your dad just did not want to accept that verdict. And they ended up getting divorced. Kareem went back to Iraq. He was working there. That was his life. He wanted to see that she got help. But your dad had quite an attitude about this, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. And it was, boy, it was just a perfect storm of disasters because Kareem brought her back hoping that she could get better and then come back with him. His plan, I know, was not to just drop her off and leave. I mean, he, mm-hmm. you know, he really loved her, and he was very appreciative of her as a, you know, as a independent modern woman who wanted to have a career, and he was supportive of that, but she didn't get better. She got worse, and through no fault of anyone's, I think at that point, I mean, she was just very sick. And mm-hmm. my dad just decided, you know, overruling anyone who might have disagreed, that he, you know, that Barb was to be kept at home and protected. I mean, I think, and I shouldn't exaggerate this, he and my mother did, you know, sort of offer my sister the option of going to a doctor and even took her to a GP. And mm-hmm. suggested going to a psychiatrist, but my sister resisted. I mean, she was very secretive about her condition. I think some people with mental illness are desperate for help, and they ask for help, but certainly not in the case of hers. And my parents didn't push it because they were, I spent a lot of time in the book trying to figure this out because it was a major, you know, condition of my life that they didn't force my sister to get help, which means they took care of her, which meant that I, as the youngest by many years, was sitting back watching this with, you know, dread and foreboding, and I didn't agree with it, and worrying, you know, what would happen eventually when I was, you know, inevitably was in charge.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the points that you bring out in your book is that your mother and Barb seem to have a telepathic communication. They just communicated in this invisible way, and you saw this so many times, and you were amazed at how very much alike they were. And you talk about your mother's anger and her tantrums that she'd have every once in a while.
Yeah.
And what impressed me about your dad is that after your mother, I believe she died.
Yes.
And then after she died, your dad was totally in charge of Barb. I mean, he had this all down, but he really had an attitude about doctors, didn't he?
Oh, he did. He was, I guess it was fear more than anything, fear and distrust, or distrust that grew from fear. And he was so angry at the suggestion that Barb be taken to a doctor. He did not trust the psychiatric profession in particular, and even, you know, just regular doctors of the physical body he was distrustful of also. And so as he got older, this became exaggerated, and he got to the point where I think he had sort of invented a story, kind of a almost a legend, as I call it in the book, for why he could not take Barb to a doctor, and how it was somehow the doctor's fault collectively that, you know, that they would somehow that recommend that she be abandoned to the system. And he just really grew in paranoia. I mean, it's ironic because my sister has been diagnosed as a paranoid schizophrenic, but my father was not, but certainly actively paranoid in his behavior.
Mm-hmm. It's a,
I sound like I sound like I'm just labeling him, and I'm sorry to do that. I don't mean to.
No,
but,
because he really did. She became his whole life.
Yeah.
And when someone becomes that obsessive, I don't care whether it's about a dog or a person or anything. I mean, it's just something where they don't allow any breathing space for anybody else or anything else.
Yeah.
And I really think he took sanctuary in your sister. And after your mother died, he was her caretaker for 10 years. I mean, he really didn't want her to think for herself or to do for herself. And that, to me, was absolutely amazing. Now, for you, you became her caretaker after these, you know, many, many years. And you've got a quote in your book that I really appreciated. It's by Dr. E. Fuller Torrey. "Schizophrenia is a cruel disease. The lives of those affected are often chronicles of constricted experiences, muted emotions, missed opportunities, unfulfilled expectations." Mm. Now, Barb coped in her own way, but she was excessively stubborn. I mean, there were things that she, your dad, just couldn't get her to do.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, you know, we're seeing a pattern here. She was stubborn. He was stubborn. And finally, when it was my turn, I was stubborn in doing what I wanted. So, yes, she was. And leaving the house was the main thing she was stubborn about not doing.
There is so much substance in your story about your family and various things. When your dad passed, you were really surprised at how well-balanced Barb was. You thought you really thought that this was going to be someone that was going to be giving you all kinds of problems, but it was just the opposite. Tell us what changed.
It was amazing, Donna. It was, I don't know what changed or everything changed. I mean, she immediately started to come out of her shell a little bit. She started to talk to me. She started to engage with the stuff in the house. You know, she had very clear ideas about what she wanted to get rid of and clear out, and which is just natural. You know, when someone dies, the stuff that has accumulated, it's natural to want to, you know, that's not the person to, you know, get rid of that stuff. But it was so normal, and it was like they had this agreement, this tacit agreement that, you know, she would just be, you know, this cowering sick person and he would be in charge of the practical details of the house. But after he died, she started to blossom just a little bit. And I'd always thought and wanted to try to, you know, thought I could maybe get her some help and wanted to try. But when she started to, you know, come out of her shell a little bit immediately, I just knew I had to give it a shot. I had to find someone who would come to the house and help me help her to stay there, because, you know, everyone was recommending that I have her committed somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And I just
mm-hmm.
did not want to do that.
Well, I found it interesting that when it came time to go through stuff, she was perfectly happy to help you do it. She was right there saying, okay, we'll do this and we'll take care of that. I mean, there was nothing there that would even really have given an indication of the severe schizophrenia that she had been in for over 30 years. It's like with the father's death, she was liberated.
I hate to think of it that way, but in a way that happened. I mean, she was still engaging in very active, acrimonious discussions with her voices. I mean, that was one thing that continued, and it was, you know, I would go over there every day for a while because I had to check up on her, and, you know, I would arrive at the house and I could hear her upstairs, and there'd be this loud conversation, and I would ask her and she would just deny anything. She just wouldn't admit that that's what she was doing. But in so many other ways, she just began to, you know, to join, you know, to sort of join back in with the world. But that was only after, after that the social worker came. And then, of course, this wonderful social worker I found, Wendy Trafney, was able to find a psychiatrist to make a house call. Mm-hmm. And that's really when things began to change.
Now, she made a comment to you that we are biological freaks.
Yeah,
now, this is a statement out of someone that you would never in a million years expect to be made. I mean, this just isn't it. But she has a cognizance. It's not like she's stupid. She's not.
No. Oh, no. You know, it's so interesting because Barb is a highly intelligent woman, and she, you know, before she got sick, you know, she was just strikingly so, you know, charismatic and interesting and curious about so many things, and she read so much. And so that's all in there somewhere, you know, and it got really scrambled and really buried for a long time. But as it began to emerge, it was so interesting to see what she was thinking about. And she began to go through all the books in the house and read them and annotate them. And, you know, she still has these theories that seem to be linked to some, you know, beliefs that are maybe, you know, maybe delusional. But yeah, that was a really interesting thing that she said. You know, after I read this book, I gave it to someone, and she said, so one of the neighbors who'd lived there for many years, and, you know, during this whole time, and said to me, oh, what will you do? Will you read it to her? And I realized she thought that my sister couldn't read. My sister was an English major, you know, so her brain is, you know, it's very much intact.
I think it's so fascinating when we know so little about the brain. And they are recognizing now where we thought at a certain age all your little gray cells would flow out, you know, through your urine and they'd be gone forever. And now they're realizing the brain can be reactivated.
Yeah.
You can have new cells develop in the brain. There is an activity level. All kinds of myths that have been promoted for generations are being thrown right out the window. And
it's
I like
thrilling.
To think that it's thrilling. That's right. And I like to think that schizophrenia, or how it is labeled at this time, there will be a deeper understanding of both the chemical, the physiological, which involves the chemical, but the mind-body connection and how all of this integrates and what we can do perhaps to bring a balance. And your sister does have some medication she takes, but she's living a life that is meaning and value at this time.
Yeah.
And your story, how we got Barb back, I just think is a story of hope in the sense that the more we can talk about these things, not run from them, but talk about them, mental illness is something that can affect anybody at any time, maybe for a short period, or maybe like with Barb, it was for most of her life. She's not going to live as a normal, whatever that is, person does, but she does have her own life, and she can hold conversations, and she's happy.
Yeah, it's great. And she has interests, and she has relationships, and she can keep track of things. She has control over things. I mean, it's, you know, she has quality of life, and, you know, everybody has their own life and their own journey, and it, you know, it's, you don't know where it's going to go, but you want a person to feel that they are enjoying and living their life. And I believe that she is now.
I would agree. I think your story is just wonderful.
Thank you.
Margaret, do you have a website that people can go to?
I don't yet have a website, but I do have an Amazon page. So if you look up my name on Amazon, it will lead you to the page, and it shows the book and some background material on the book. And it also has a link to a book trailer that shows some more pictures of Barb from her youth, and in which I talk a little bit more about the circumstances of the book.
Well, Margaret, it has been wonderful to having you as a guest. Your book, How We Got Barb Back, is absolutely beautifully done. I compliment you on your honesty, your courage, and the fact that you brought out of the closet a lot of information about your family's pain and what they had to grow through. Some of them grew well, others didn't grow at all. But I think you've given a gift, because this is something that could be very helpful to people that maybe are experiencing something with a loved one of their own, or maybe they know a friend that's having some challenges. And I think your book is wonderfully insightful. Again, How We Got Barb Back, Margaret Hawkins. Go to Amazon.com. You'll find the page under her name, Margaret Hawkins. Thank you again, Margaret, for being my guest.
Thank you so much, Donna. It's been such a pleasure.
This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. We're going to come back in just a little bit. Don't go away. More good things to share.
If you're searching for the perfect gift for a child, consider God's Kiss by Donna Sebo. That's right. Donna is not only a mental practitioner and psychic, she's an author as well. God's Kiss beckons all children and the young at heart to enter the dream world of a little traveler named Johnny. You can order your book today by sending a check or money order to Mrs. Sebo's Classics, Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. That's Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. If you'd like both the book and cassette, you pay only $19.95 plus applicable tax and shipping charges. This is the book for your favorite child of any age. Donna Sebo's God's Kiss is about a child's sense of place in the world, and it's destined to be a children's classic. Order now. Call 1-800-872-8852. That's 1-800-872-8852. God's Kiss is written by Donna Sebo and illustrated by Ed Gedros. Buy it today. 1-800-872-8852.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature. However, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Hi, this is Donna. Telephone lines are now open, so if you'd like to call in and chat with me, I would be delighted to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight. Give me a call at 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756. Now, that's a toll-free worldwide phone number, so you can call in from anywhere. All I need from you is your first name or your initial, and then after that, let me tell you what I perceive. I'd also like to know where you're calling in from. I'm always interested in that. And then you can ask me a question when I'm finished. This is my way, and I've been doing this now going on 9 years. I really enjoy sharing the intuitive talents with people because I think it's important to realize that intuition, psychic ability, isn't something to be feared. It's something to be understood. and I consider myself an information resource. So if you'd like to get some information from this resource, give me a call at 888-815-9756. Now, also, I want to remind you, deadline January 1, 2011. I want your story of a personal experience that you've had or experiences that you've had with the paranormal or what you would define as the paranormal. This I'm interested in because I want to share these stories with a lot of different people and I'd like for yours to be included. So if you've had a unique experience, whether it's out of the body or you've had dreams that have come true, why don't you write your story out, send it to me, Donna at DelphiInternational.com. That's the website, Donna at DelphiInternational.com. And I'm going to be putting it into my file that I'm putting these other stories into, and I so appreciate those of you that have sent me your story. It's amazing the variables of experiences that people have. So it doesn't make any difference when it occurred. I just want to know your story because I think the more we can share our story with others, the more we empower people that might be afraid to talk about their experiences and to try to understand them and use them in the right way, the better we are going to be overall. You know, when I was interviewing Margaret about her sister Barbara, I thought it takes courage, it really does, to be able to open yourself up to a greater potential of knowledge and understanding. And I don't know of anyone that goes through life, doesn't have their challenges, and so many times we hold them all stowed up inside of ourselves because we feel like there's a stigma or a shame, depending on the environment we have been raised in. And our fears take over. And sometimes they can cripple us in our lives. Well, Noah Ben-Shea is a wonderful individual, and I want to share some words that he wrote with you because I really think that this man has a profound philosophy, and I like the way he stated it. He said, imagine your life as a wagon filled with everything you represent, one where you need horses. Now imagine that your fears and your faith are those horses. And of course, all of us have more fears than faith. So let us say we have 11 horses of fear and only one horse of faith. If we put any of the horses of fear at the head of the team, they will be hesitant to lead. They'll be unsure of their capacity, afraid they'll not be able to do what is expected of them. But if you put the one single horse of faith as the lead, the horses of fear will follow. In fact, our fears, when led by our faith, will provide the strength to pull our wagon. The challenge for all of us is to put our faith and not our fears in charge. These are words of wisdom that really can carry us through. Because hardship can hit in a guise we never would have imagined. It happens. That's what life does. Perfection, it doesn't exist, but you can always aim for it. But if you allow fear to cause you to not move forward, then you're just going to stay in the same spot. You'll never be able to take your wagon anywhere. And sadly, I've known of people, and I've even been in the situation myself, where I've been so frozen with fear that I could hardly breathe. Have you ever felt like that? It's happened to me. But somewhere within the South, you have to say, I'm going to move forward. And I can remember a moment in my life when I was being terrorized by an individual. And this individual had such a knowledge of a young woman's psyche. He knew exactly how to play it to create that feeling of powerlessness in another person. However, I found within myself a capacity of recognizing that I had to tell other people what was going on. So that empowered me, and I can remember standing in front of this individual being absolutely almost numb with fear. I couldn't breathe. It was all I could do to play act the positioning of strength and a lack of fear, because I was experiencing exactly the opposite. But play the part, I did. And then I realized, and I was 19 years old, that I could be in control of a situation that seemingly was not possible to control. And I could take dominion over my mind and my actions and my attitude. That lesson has stayed with me throughout my entire life. It wasn't an easy lesson to learn, but I had to conquer the fear. And the only way I knew how to conquer the fear was face it. And that is an adage that has been passed along from one generation to another. But until you experience it, you just don't know what you're capable of doing. And there's that spark inside of you that can empower you and make you realize that you're the one that has control over your mind, your actions. You have the thinking capacity. And you don't turn your mind over to anybody. It makes a difference. It empowers you. And it's something we have to learn. So I don't know how old you are, any of you that are listening. It doesn't really make any difference. But we have things hit us at times that can cause us to feel totally paralyzed, immobilized. We get scared, and it's going to happen. I don't care what your age is. But you must remember, there is that greatness inside of you that will tell you you can overcome it and you can even be bigger, better, and stronger than you ever dreamed. Life does demand participation. The worst thing you can do is to run from it. So, as Noah said, put the horse in front of the wagon. Make sure your lead horse is one of faith and understanding so that you can take those fears that you may have and make them move according to the beat of action you want them to follow. This is Donna Sebo. We're going to be taking a break. When I come back, I have a fabulous story about a mom who owes a wonderful gift that she was given by a bunch of teenagers. She owes these teenagers a debt of gratitude that is unbelievable. I'll tell you all about this story when we come back. Donna Sebo here if you want to chat, 888-815-9756. We'll be right back.
Enter the magical world of God's kiss.
Johnny finds himself at the entrance to a large open valley framed by high mountains rich in the brown red colors of the earth. He stands in awe, even a little fearful of the mountain's great size. After all, he's just a little boy and not very tall.
God's Kiss is a beautifully illustrated children's book about a young boy's journey into a valley with children and animals from all over the world. They are gathering together to experience the wonder of love and beauty that will affect their lives forever. A talking book audio narrated by the author Donna Sebo accompanies this wonderful storybook, creating a special magic all of its own. This book package makes a wonderful gift for those special children in your life ages 3 to 10. God's Kiss book and talking book audio are only $19.95 plus shipping and handling, and the author Donna Sebo will autograph and personalize your book if you request it. Call 800-872-8852. You can also order through Donna Sebo's website, www.delphiinternational.com. That 800 number again, 872-8852.
As a counselor, Donna Sebo is available for private consultations by appointment. These can be done by telephone or in person. If you'd like to schedule an appointment with Donna, call 253-582-5604 or 800-872-8852. That's 253-582-5604 or outside of Pierce County, 800-872-8852.
Hi,
Hi, this is Donna. Quick like a bunny, I want to let you know tomorrow we are going to have an open mic day. So that means from the beginning of the hour till the end, the telephone lines will be open and you'll be able to call in whenever you like. So I'm going to have a little bit of this, a little bit of that, and maybe a recipe or two to share with you. And, of course, Halloween is coming up. So just know we've got a lot of good things we're going to be talking about and sharing. And, again, the telephone lines will be open tomorrow for the entire show. It's going to be an open mic day. Now, I mentioned that there is this wonderful story that I came across about a woman by the name of Lisa. You know, she's a single mom, and she had a baby boy, and she thought she was going to have a perfect life. Well, by the time she had her little boy, was 2 years old, she was single. She'd been married before, and she ended up being single. Now, she had a job. She was working in a retail store, and she said it was really, really tough because they were always constantly concerned about money. And having been in that situation, I know exactly how she feels. She got very discouraged because living in an apartment, her little boy, where they were living, didn't have access to a yard. And she said, oh, I'll never be able to afford a home. Well, her parents wanted to have her come and live with them, but she said, you know, it's going to be awful tight, and their home was pretty small. But Lisa wanted to get a degree because she thought that's the only way she's going to be able to make more money, as if she had a degree, and she was right in that estimation. So the parents watched their grandson, her parents watched their grandson, and she went to class, and she was working at the same time to pay her tuition. So pretty tight circumstances. Now, by the time her son was five, she had gotten her associate's degree, but the dream of owning her own home, she just didn't ever think was going to happen. Well, as it turned out, she was, pretty good friends with a number of her classmates. And in one class, I guess they asked her about what one of her dreams was, and she said to own her own home, but she could not see that there was a possibility for it. Now, one of her professors said, why don't you apply to the Habitat for Humanity? Maybe they can help you out. And she thought, yeah, that's not going to work. But her curiosity got the better of her. So she went online and found out what the requirements were. Income level, they matched the income level. Need for housing, that was something they could do. Would a person be willing to pitch in to build their own house? And so she's going through all these questions, and she's saying, yeah, she could do all of that. So she sent in an application, and she said, I'm trying to build a better life for my son. I wish I could give him a yard and a place where he can be himself, a place he could call home. Well, she sent this in, and part of her said, I hope. Another part of her said, there's a lot of other people that are going to be applying. It's not going to make any difference. Well, after a number of weeks, she graduated. She got a job as a medical assistant. And then months passed. She checked the mailbox, and to her amazement, there was an envelope from the Habitat for Humanity. Now, she was sort of afraid to open it because it was so thin. There wasn't a lot of paper in it. And she thought, oh, I know I've been rejected. But she wasn't. They said that they were going to help her build a home. Now, she had to take classes on finances and workshops on building. And then, a particular day, there was a director from the Habitat for Humanity that said, let me show you where your house is going to be. Well, this was just absolutely mind-boggling. There was an empty lot, and it was not that far from where her folks lived and very close to her son's school. Now, there had been a dilapidated house that had been on this property. They had torn it all down, and, of course, here's a great big hole in the ground. And when she saw it, she could just visualize how it was going to be absolutely perfect.
Well, all of a sudden, she is made aware of who's going to be building this for her. She was stunned. It was a bunch of high school students. That's right, high school students. Now, they were going to be all supervised, but they were going to be her builders. And, of course, she was thinking, teenagers, you've got to be kidding. Teenagers building a house? More than 100 students from 7 different high schools began coming by to help. And at least 20 worked each shift. She got to know a number of them. And she asked them, why are you doing this? And these teenagers said, well, it's because it's just a real cool thing to do. This is fun. We're having a good time doing it. Now, there's a lot of work when you build a house. You've got to put in the foundation. You've got to get the structure all set up, put in insulation, there's hammering. I mean, it's just a lot of back-breaking work and a lot of painting. And we're not talking about a few days here. It's hundreds of hours to complete a home. But the teenagers and the people that worked with them were having fun. The girls would sing, the boys would join in, and sometimes they had paint fights, and there was all kinds of stuff. But Lisa found that there was an interaction between herself and these young people, and the girls would ask her advice, and she ended up just absolutely amazed. And, of course, she was helping out on the house, too. Now, eventually, the house was finished, and the house ended up going through a ceremony where it was blessed. And how this was done, I thought was just amazing. Family, friends, and the entire crew of these teenagers and supervisors went from room to room in the house. And what they did, they made wishes out loud. Well, it was amazing. The day came for her to move in. She absolutely loves her home. I've got a picture of it in front of me. It's just really amazing. And she said, to think I owe it all to 100 teenagers, young people that enabled a dream that I had to come true. Who would have ever thought that teenagers would be interested in this? The reason I wanted to share the story with you is so that we realize that there are a lot of very, very fine young people. We hear so much stuff about teenagers that are in trouble and drugs, destructive in one way or another. But do you know the majority of them aren't? They really want to make a difference in life. And when they're given a good example and they participate in something that has meaning for them, they're going to be right up there where they should be, demonstrating that they're responsible citizens and they like being a part of making a difference in someone's life. So Lisa and her son Damon have their home, and their life is rich with purpose and promise. After a lot of work, by a lot of caring people, kids as well as adults. This is Donna Seabold. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. God bless. Have a fabulous day wherever you are. Keep that sunshine smile going. This world needs it. We need a lot more light in what is seemingly a very dark period. So keep it going. Talk to you tomorrow, same time, same place, right here, bbsradio.com. The Donna Seabold Show. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Seabold Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Seabold Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.